All right, quick review. The book of John is a gospel of faith or belief. That's correct. And what sets John apart from the synoptic gospels is a lot of different things. But in particular, dealing with John gives us a very specific purpose for why he wrote the things that he wrote. And John's very different from the synoptic gospels, where a lot of different miracles are recorded in those. How many miracles are recorded in the book of John, specifically?
Seven.
And then corresponding to that, there's also the seven I am statements. And there was a handout last week. I promised I'd have a better one this week, and I lied. I don't have one for you. I will soon, so I apologize for that. This weekend was busier than I anticipated for it to be. But that being said, when you go back to John's preface, his thesis for why he's writing what he writes, he says, you know, not even all of the books in the world could contain everything if everything was written down. But he gets back to the crux and says, these things have been written for you so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. That's the purpose for everything John wrote, and that's going to be the lens that we have to see the miracles through, specifically why he wrote each one of these, and all of the different signs that accompanied Jesus' ministry. Now, when we left off last week, we left off with the very first specific miracle that John records for us, and that is Jesus also at a wedding, where he turns this water to wine. And I don't want to rehash the whole text because we left off reading it last week, but where we left off was asking this specific question. And that is, when we look at John's purpose, so that you might, these things were written so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ and the Son of God. If this is the lens we need to see everything John writes through, why does John record this miracle of Jesus turning water into wine? What about this instance or this scenario leads us to believing Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God? Because the disciples here are going to have the same response. When you look in verse 11, after he's done this, it says, this, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, or made known his glory. And his disciples believed in him. Now, why would it record this? What about this sign leads his disciples and would lead those who are reading John's writings to believe Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, because he merely turned water into wine? Kevin, go ahead. Okay, this perhaps is the very first sign or very first miracle Jesus did, period. Not only recorded by John, but perhaps just period. Yeah, Gary.
He was also very careful to make sure he had never touched the water or anything, so they couldn't say he had something to do with it.
Right, this isn't just, you know, some kind of a magic trick that Jesus has done. He's changed the, you know, the chemical makeup of this substance. It's no longer water. This is wine, and it's the best wine. It's the good wine. Okay, so good answer. What else would lead someone to believe that this, though, is the Christ? Like, perhaps a great teacher or someone who can perform great signs, a prophet. But John says these things were written for you to believe that he was the Christ, not just a prophet. And I struggled with that, looking at this miracle for a long time, as to what is it about this that points us to this being the one who is going to be the Messiah because of this sign. And so let's just offer a few things as we look at this. Dan Petty was one of my instructors at Florida College, and he gives an entire section given to the signs of Jesus in one of the lectures, God So Loved, based on the book of John. And he discusses a couple of things for us to consider and think about as to perhaps why this one specifically was recorded and why Jesus did this in the first place for people to believe that he was the Christ. And here's a couple of options. Dan begins by writing, by turning the water to wine, Jesus demonstrated that he is Lord of creation and master of matter. I think Phoebe said this last week, where each time you look at one of the signs recorded by John, it demonstrates Christ's authority or mastership over a particular subject or over a particular thing. And in this case, in being able to just without, you know, touching, without anything, change the chemical makeup of something from water to wine, what does that demonstrate Jesus' mastership over or his control over?
Elements.
What's that?
Everything.
Yeah. Well, everything, maybe that's broad.
Elements.
Right. The elements, the things of this world, creation. Water is the, you know, the thing that makes up the majority of this world, the majority of our bodies. And if Jesus can take that and turn it into this drink that was to be enjoyed by everyone at this wedding feast, that demonstrates that Jesus has control over nature, over creation. But there's perhaps more to it than that. Dan goes on to write, he created both the water and the wine that through natural process produced grapes and became wine. Thus, he has the power to turn water to wine instantaneously apart from the vine. The sign furthermore, though, revealed him to be the master of quality. Remember, when Jesus provided this wine and it was taken and shown to kind of the maitre d', or he's called the, in the ESV, I'm not sure what his title is. Let me look again. The master of the feast, that's it. But basically the maitre d', and he takes it to the bridegroom. The bridegroom is surprised because he says, normally we serve the best first, and then you serve that which is of lesser quality later after they've drunk their fill. But you, he's surprised, the bridegroom is, towards the maitre d', who's showing him all this great wine now, you've saved the best for last. Now, I'm going to try to paint this in a very, you know, obvious way to see what it points to. Normally, the best was first, and then you would have that which is not, you know, of poor, you know, not unimportant, but of lesser quality second. What Jesus does is, in turning the water to wine, that which was thought to be the best first actually turned out to be the lesser, and that which was provided by Jesus turned out to be better than that which was thought was best. All right, now that is a very long way of trying to speak and beat around the bush, but I want you to put a messianic spin on this. Because when the Jews looked at their relationship to God in the Old Covenant, they believed that this was it, that they were the children of God, and that they had the law and they had the temple. And when they conceived of a Messiah to come, what was the kind of things that they thought the Messiah was going to do, the Jews as a nation? Right, run off the Romans, make Israel a physical great kingdom again, those types of things. And it all surrounded their understanding of the law and that which they thought was best. But Jesus, what's the whole point of the book of Hebrews? If you're going to condense Hebrews into one sentence, it's Jesus is what?
Better.
And that's what the writer spends all his time talking about, that he's the enactor of a better covenant with better promises. And that which was thought was superior actually turned out to be lesser and only lead to that which was better or best. Dan also goes on to write, the sign furthermore, we already read that, it showed Jesus dealing with man's inability to cope with normal demands of human life. Since John states that the water pots were for Jewish custom of purification, some suggest the whole incident was intended to symbolize the inadequacy of the old dispensation with its merely ceremonial cleansing and the richness of the new. In favor of this latter view is the fact that the miracle at Cana is followed by John's account of the cleansing of the temple, which is what we're about to see. on occasion which Jesus speaks of the destruction of Jerusalem temple and the resurrection of the temple of his body. Now, the argument here is that the context supports this messianic lens or this viewpoint right here. That which Jesus provided was better and was best than that which was originally given. And so when we see this miracle, Jesus is not just demonstrating his power over creation and his power over the elements, but Jesus is teaching us something about himself. That which he has to offer is better than that which man has to offer and is better than that which was given to begin with. Jesus is the fulfillment of the law and the prophets. Yeah.
One of the things that I really go back to is in verse 3 and 4.
Okay.
And it deals with the faith and compassion that Jesus had. And the faith that Mary, the mother of Jesus, had in her son. And a lot of times I think that is overlooked in this. And when they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." Mm-hmm. And that's in parentheses. Goes on and says, Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come."
Right.
But again, it's about the faith that Mary had in Jesus, even though to this point no miracle had been done. Mm-hmm. But she knew who he was.
Right.
And he could do all things. And that's the faith that Mary had. We are in a predicament here. Jesus has compassion. And out of that compassion, then uses it for the glory of God at the same time.
Right.
But it's just amazing at his compassion. And all the signs that follow from here are out of compassion.
Right. Good.
And it's powerful.
Good. Very good. Anything else on this? What are things that you take from this or that you can see that appeal to Jesus as the Christ or the Son of God from turning the water into wine? Any other thoughts about that? All right. Let's go ahead and move on in the context because we want to get through all of our text today. We now come to a very interesting account. And because of that, this isn't an account that we're unfamiliar with, but it's an account that perhaps we might, looking at it on the surface level, looks like it's in the wrong place. And that is, the next account told by John is during the Passover of the Jews when Jesus, he says, goes up to Jerusalem and cleanses out the temple. Now, when you look at the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, this event is recorded not at the beginning of Jesus' ministry, but this event is recorded at the very end of Jesus' ministry when he goes into Jerusalem to be crucified. Okay? So, there's some chronology issues here, and we have some things that we need to consider. What is actually taking place here? So there's a lot of argument amongst scholars and amongst biblical students for many, many hundreds of years surrounding this text. And here are kind of the conclusions that people have come up with. Here are the options. Option number one is that the Synoptic Gospels are right and that John is wrong. And that, you know, the evidence that three authors testify that this event took place at the end of Jesus' ministry demonstrate that perhaps John just got this detail wrong or was an error or put it in the wrong place. The other argument, of course, is that no, John was right and the synoptics were wrong. John has more of an insight. He was the disciple whom Jesus loved, so he would have a better, accurate, thorough knowledge of the signs of Jesus. I believe those are poor conclusions to come to. Let's look at a couple more. One of the thoughts, and there is some merit to this, although this isn't necessarily what I believe, is there perhaps John intentionally took this event and took this recording of what happened and intentionally put it out of place from the end of Jesus' ministry to the beginning of his ministry. Now, if we're going to offer up that, conclusion, there has to be some heavy evidence as to why would John do something like that. And the greatest argument actually lies in this passage contextually explaining Jesus' first sign of the water to wine. And that Jesus is demonstrating that this temple is what you believe is the temple of God, but in actuality, there's a better temple. I'm going to tear it down, and in 3 days, I'm going to raise it up again. And so some argue that in the context, this passage demonstrates and shows, helps to explain John's first sign. I don't believe that that's what's going on here. What I believe we have is two different events, and John simply is the only one that records this one, this event. Because John does not record it again later on, that doesn't mean that John doesn't believe it took place when he went back into Jerusalem. It just means that John was selective in the things that he chose to write about and the things he didn't. Case in point, John records only 7 miracles, and of course it's because of his purpose, his thesis. Would it be a sound argument to then argue that because John doesn't record any of the other miracles that the synoptic writers wrote about, that they were correct and John was wrong? That John intended to say by not recording those miracles that they didn't happen? I mean, that's just foolish. We have 4 different perspectives, 4 different authors that are going to cover different areas of Jesus' ministry and different signs. And just because one is not recorded by the others does not mean they were wrong and the others were right, or does not mean that it didn't happen. John simply is giving us an account that's not recorded by Matthew, Mark, or Luke, and he himself does not record the account later on in Jesus' ministry that Matthew, Mark, and Luke do write about. That's what I believe is taking place here. That being said, let's go ahead and actually read the text and talk about this cleansing of the temple. Verse 13, it begins, "The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And in the temple, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons and the money changers sitting there." Let's just stop there before we look at Jesus' reaction. In the Passover, Jews, not only, of course, that lived in Jerusalem, but from all over, were coming to Jerusalem to offer up their sacrifices. Now, I want to ask this question because these are the leaders of the people. These are, you know, Pharisees and Sadducees and the priests of the temple, and they have started this exchange inside the temple grounds where they're selling oxen and sheep and goats, and they're exchanging money for people. Why were they doing that? What was their motivation behind this? Go ahead.
They were making a lot of money from the people's sin. The people, if they were traveling there, couldn't bring those animals with them.
Well, okay.
So they would sell them there.
Okay.
And the more sin, the more they sold.
All right. According to Levitical law, when you look at the different offerings that are recorded in Leviticus chapters 1 through 7, really, and the emphasis on those, the burnt offering and the sin offering and the grain offering and the peace offering, you were supposed to bring the best of what you possessed. And the type of animal depended on the type of sacrifice, and also depended on some of those sacrifices on your social class. Those who were well off would offer the oxen or the goat, but there was provisions made for those that were not well off, and they could offer 2 turtle doves. That gives us some insight into Jesus' family, because when they come to offer up sacrifices in Jerusalem, they offer the poorest sacrifice, the one of the turtle doves. But that being said, why would you, in this time period, traveling was difficult. If you're coming, imagine if you're trying to bring your whole family down 100 miles, but you also, in doing that, have to bring with you 5 oxen or 4 goats and all these birds. Is that going to make your journey more difficult, more expensive? You know, all these types of things. And so those who were running the temple at this time saw an opportunity to capitalize on the sins of the people and their need to sacrifice. Because how much more appealing would it be if you could just take your family, not have to worry about all your own herds back home, leave those there, show up at the temple, and just kind of buy one when you get there and offer it as a sacrifice? Jesus, of course, is not going to be pleased with this, and there's going to be a couple of reasons why. First of all, is going to be the fact that the leaders of the people are using this opportunity, the sinfulness of the people, to capitalize for their monetary gain. But there's something else here in regards to the people. When you purchased an animal, if they're selling all of these animals for people to purchase for sacrifice, what do you think the quality of those was? Okay. If you're just showing up and kind of buying what you can get when you get there, does that match the description behind God's requirements for sacrifice? I mean, this is no longer even a sacrifice. This, you have made that which was supposed to be God's gift for you, and you've turned it into an opportunity to really spit in God's face and make it what is convenient for you. Yeah.
It was like you said, the best of what you had, and in this case, you're buying from somebody else and keeping the best that you have at your own place for convenience sake.
Okay. And that's exactly what that gets back to. All right, this is what I want to take a moment to look at before we look at Christ's response. The third reason is because there was absolutely no authority for what they were doing within the temple. The temple was God's house. It was dedicated for the worship and the praise of God, not to be turned into a money-making marketplace, which is a great tongue twister. Yeah, Bruce.
Kind of a background. I'm a Jew, and this is what I'm supposed to do, and I'm going to go do what I want to do the rest of the time. But, you know, so there, you can see the falling off from
right.
their conviction to God.
Okay, good.
With that, I go back to the time, and because God was very specific, and you go back to the time of the tabernacle, and God gave specific directions to Moses in regards to, like, Aaron and his sons, the garments that they wore, etc., and how they must wash their hands and their feet. If they violated even one part of that, the sentence was death. Mm-hmm. It's a serious matter what God required of them. And the temple is to be a house of prayer, mm-hmm. not one to do the money changing, as you mentioned. And it just shows how far removed they have come from what God expected from them and where they're at currently.
Okay.
And that's the whole reason why the next things that transpire is that Jesus is going to show them. He loses it in a righteous anger because you've lost the purpose.
Right, right. Good. So I want to just take this opportunity to look at a couple of applications for us, and especially just to the Christian world in general. When you look at what was going on at the temple here, do we not see all three of these things still taking place among groups that consider themselves Christian today? When you look at the money aspect, turning, you know, worship to God into an opportunity to make money. When you look at, you know, it started with perhaps maybe it didn't start with televangelism, but that was maybe perhaps the most prominent way that took place. You know, call in and dedicate your money to us, or all these big rallies where they would do, quote, faith healings. Have you ever seen those? And that's just a big lie. There's no healing that's taking place there. But if you pay and contribute this amount of money, then you could attend these and then you could be healed. And, of course, that doesn't take place. But oftentimes churches will turn not even just deceit into an opportunity for capitalization, but churches will get all invested in investing, buying companies, buying products, buying, you know, coffee houses even, or different things like that, because they see it as an opportunity for them to make money. The problem is, the church is not in the business of making money. The church is not a business. And when we begin to take that which God intended to glorify Him and simply worship Him and turn it into an opportunity for our personal gain, we are just as guilty as the Jews here who had turned the temple into this marketplace. Second problem that we still see today is the people were okay with this because it was convenient for them. And when you look at how people approach God today, the God that they're willing to serve is the God that which is most convenient for them. The church that people want to go to is based on convenience. When you ask people oftentimes, why do you go to church here? Some of the answers you'll get is, oh, well, it's just around the corner because it's convenient. Now, there's something to be said for a local group. It doesn't matter whether you live right around the corner or a little further away. But if that's your whole reasoning, that's a problem. The reasoning given, well, I can bring my coffee in or I can wear this. It's because it's what's comfortable for you. It's because it's more convenient for you. Oftentimes, people will want to attend certain churches because, well, their doctrine allows me to live this particular way. I don't have to sacrifice these things. Well, if we've turned the worship of God into that which is convenient for us, then we've completely missed the whole thing. Yeah, go ahead.
Bob Schuller, when he started in Southern California, the Christian Cathedral, was all premised on convenience because he started off in an old drive-in movie theater.
So right.
When people had been out partying all night, Saturday night, then they could come there and not even have to get out of the car. They could come and feel better about coming to church. So
right.
They'd pull into the drive-in.
Right, drive-in church.
Drive-in church because it was convenient. So mm-hmm. They didn't have to change clothes, they didn't have to do anything.
Right. There's also drive-through church for a while. The fast food industry gave someone an idea, and there was drive-through church. You pulled through, got communion, listened to a 5-10-minute lesson, then you pulled away. Convenience. When you think about different groups that they, you know, we live stream and, or we don't live stream, but we upload videos for people to watch later. But a lot of times churches will live stream what's going on and people decide, well, because I can hear the lessons from my tablet at home, I no longer have any need to come and be with anyone else. And that whole attitude is motivated by, well, what's convenient for me? And if that's our attitude, regardless of any of these things, regardless of what it is, if I'm allowing my worship and my walk with God to be ruled by what is convenient for me, then I'm not going to be serving God in my walk and in my life. The last application really is when you look at simply the authority question. I don't want to harp on this because we talk about it a lot, but that was not the purpose for the temple. That was not the purpose for why they were there. Now, was there anything wrong with outside of the temple, outside of the grounds, buying animals? Or exchanging money, or all these, there's nothing wrong with that, but that belonged in the marketplace. And see, the whole point of this that churches can get caught up in is we can take good things that God wants us to do, and we take those good things and we make them the mission of the church. Brethren, the mission of the church is to seek and save the lost. That's our mission, is to go and make disciples of all nations. We're not in the business of starting social clubs or different things like that. There's no authority for that. That's not what the point of the church is. I just met with a young man this last week, a friend of mine, and we had had a falling out, and he messaged me and said, I really need to get together with you. I want to apologize to you, and it was just a great meeting. But he was at a crisis in his faith, and one of the things we discussed was he said, you know, I was not feeling connected to the church, and I was not feeling lifted up or fed, and I'd realized that these churches I was a part of, and these are his words, he's like, it was just a big social club. It was all about just different social events, and I wasn't being fed spiritually. And it was amazing because just the words he was using and the conclusions he came to just by opening up the Bible again. And he said, and God was really asking me a question, am I going to let his word be his word or not? And if I am, then I need to get back to that and get away from all these types of different things. And the conclusions he'd come to is he'd recognize that many churches have abused God's authority and allowed good things that we should be doing in our lives as Christians to become the mission and the purpose of the church. And if we've done that, we've completely missed the point as well. So I just wanted to talk about those things really quick. Any other thoughts or questions on that before we look at Jesus' response to this? All right. What Jesus does next does not give you authority to do the following. I'm just going to preface that, okay? Verse 15, in making a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple. Jesus makes a whip and starts whipping people and their animals and different things and drives everybody out of the temple grounds with the sheep and the oxen. And he poured out the coins of the money changers and he overturned their tables. Would this be a spectacle to see? I mean, and who's going to stop him, by the way? I mean, people are recognizing him as a powerful new teacher, a powerful new rabbi. We're going to see in chapter 3 in just a moment, Nicodemus is going to come to him, and he is actually among the elite of the Pharisees, and he says, we know, speaking of many of the Pharisees, that you must be a teacher from God, because no one can perform the signs that you are without actually being from God. So who's going to stop Jesus? But Jesus turns over all their tables, all their coins, and he told those who sold the pigeons, take these things away and do not make my Father's house a house of trade. Jesus there emphasizes whose house this is, whose authority this is under. Kylie and I one day hope to own a home. Bruce owns a home. I like picking on Bruce. Bruce is my guy. So Bruce is going to go on vacation, right? And before he goes on vacation, I'll tell you what Bruce does not have to do. Bruce does not have to come to me and to all his neighbors and go, now, before I leave, I don't want you to take out all my grass and put down gravel. And I don't want you to repaint all my walls. And I don't want you to remodel, you know, my bedroom a certain way. He doesn't have to go around and tell everyone, don't do these things. Why? Because it belongs to Bruce. It's under his authority. And I don't do anything to his house if he has not explicitly told me to do so. He does not have to tell me what I don't have to do or what not to do specifically because it's his to begin with. We understand that. That's how authority works. This was God's house. And many people, in their response to an argument from authority, will say, well, God never said that I couldn't. Well, you're missing the point. God doesn't have to. This belongs to him. This is his authority. And this was his house. And his disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house will consume me. Okay? Let's just talk about this for a moment. What gave Jesus the right to respond this way, to act in this way, to make a whip and drive them outside of the temple like he did? Yeah, go ahead.
I think one reason is because the prophets were held in high esteem with the people. By driving them out, he showed them that they did not belong there.
Okay, so Jesus is demonstrating a statement also about who he is. You know, early on in his childhood, remember when his parents leave Jerusalem and they get a little ways and recognize Jesus isn't there. When they come back, what was Jesus' response to them? Did you not know that I would be busy about my Father's house, my Father's business? This belonged to Jesus. He belonged there. They did not. Okay, good. What else? What gave Jesus the authority to do something like this or act in this way?
The law itself.
Okay. How so?
The law said what they were supposed to do and how they were supposed to do it. And there was nothing said about having money changers or animals or anything inside the temple.
All right. So they needed to be removed, and Jesus was the one to remove them. But what gave Jesus that authority? Go ahead.
I find it very interesting that Jesus did take on the sin of all man.
Right.
And you know that it's a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. And there's two sides to it.
Okay. Right.
Am I right?
No, you're absolutely correct. With love, there has to be also judgment upon that which is unrighteous and unloving. Okay, good. Mick.
I
Right.
Vision, but
right.
I think there's a huge lesson there that kind of measures us where we are in life.
Okay. Okay. Mick.
God said, "This is my son in whom I'm well pleased. Hear ye him."
All right. We're getting to the crux of it. Go ahead. Okay.
You have every right to step in and say, knock it off.
All right. That's it. Jesus is the Son of God. That's what John had said. That is the conclusion that Nathanael had come to when he recognized who Jesus was. He says, "You are the Christ, the Son of God." That's what the Lord said at his baptism. "This is my Son in whom I'm well pleased." Jesus demonstrates his authority in appealing to whose house this belongs to in the first place. He says, not your father's house. He says, this is my father's house. Jesus belonged there. He is under authority. This is his establishment, his place. And truly, this was not really the temple. He was actually the true temple. And if they are going to treat this temple in such a way and desecrate it, how do you think they were then going to treat the actual temple of Jesus Christ? And of course, we know that answer. They're going to reject and kill him and destroy that temple just like they were doing right then with this one. Phoebe, you had your hand up as well.
I was just going to say they were totally misrepresenting to anybody who looked at the purpose of what the temple was. And so Jesus corrected that.
Right, right. He finishes it and fixes it right away. And that's what we need to recognize as Christ's authority. This is his house. And the judgment that he enacts here is very merciful in many ways. It could have been much different. Verse 18. So the Jews said to him, "What signs do you show us for doing these things?" In other words, they're asking, by what authority do you have to drive out these people in the way that you have? And to demonstrate that, you need to show us a sign, right? The problem is, Jesus has already been doing signs. We've already seen that. But they don't like what Jesus has done, so they're going to challenge him. And so Jesus is going to respond. He says to them, "This is the sign that I'm going to show you. I will destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up again." Their response is, it's taken 46 years to build this temple, and you raise it up in 3 days? But, of course, he was speaking about the temple of his body. When, therefore, he was raised from the dead, John's going to make an aside here to talk about later on. When he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scriptures and the words that Jesus had spoken. What we have here is a sign that Jesus is going to give that would not have been understood until 3 years later. It was not understood by them what Jesus meant. They're confused because Jesus says, "I'm going to destroy this temple, I'm going to build it back up in 3 days." And of course, they're thinking physical. And they're thinking, "Okay, Jesus, I know you're a carpenter, but that's pretty arrogant. That's pretty boastful for you to think that you're as good of a carpenter that you can build this temple back up in 3 days. But that's not, of course, what Jesus was talking about. Jesus is going to give this statement of truth, and this is the sign he's going to show them. What gives you authority to say that you can do these things? Well, I'll show you what authority. I'm going to raise from the dead. I'm going to demonstrate that I am truly the Son of God. And it was when that happened that the disciples, after seeing him and touching him and knowing him, just fall back and recognize, this is the Son of God. And they believe the scriptures, they believe Jesus' words. Yeah, Dave.
I like the way he puts it here too, in the fact that he uses it just like he did when he spoke with many of the people in that day in parables. It's taking something and laying it aside to something else to make a spiritual point. And that's what he does here. He talks about the physical temple,
and what they had done to it, and him being the spiritual temple, and then showing them that he would raise it up in 3 days. And the fact that the disciples then would remember that he said these things, just like he talked in the parables, and sometimes they didn't understand.
Right.
Could you please give us more instruction and explain it? And then he does.
Right.
And in this one, they would realize it later. It's such a beautiful way
right.
to talk.
And I think I'm going to make this argument. I believe when they were asking these things, that they weren't actually interested in seeing a sign so as to believe. Because remember when the people asked for a sign later on, Jesus is going to give a similar answer. He says, an evil and adulterous generation asked for a sign. But this sign, and only this sign, will be given to you. And he gives the sign of Jonah. And that just as Jonah was in the belly of a whale 3 days and then came back to life, so to speak, so the Son of Man will be in the earth 3 days and on the third day will rise again. Jesus gives the same answer with two different examples. In one, he says, I'm going to tear down this temple and I'm going to raise it up in 3 days. In the latter, he refers to a prophet, Jonah, and that what took place to Jonah happened to demonstrate what was going to take place to the Son of Man, to the Messiah. But in either case, both times they say, we want to see a sign. And Jesus appeals to the only true sign that anyone would actually need to affirm his deity as the Son of God. It wasn't going to necessarily be turning water to wine. It wasn't going to be healing people. The ultimate sign that would demonstrate his authority and who he was is that he would be resurrected from the dead. And that's how Jesus is going to leave them here. And it's going to make a powerful, powerful statement. And we didn't even get to the beginning of chapter 3 today. But we will next week. And Nicodemus is going to come to Jesus. He's a Pharisee. He's one of the foremost teachers of Israel, as Jesus refers to him. Are you not the teacher of Israel? And we're going to see that he doesn't quite understand who Jesus is yet, but he's intrigued and he wants to know more. And Jesus is going to point again to his resurrection for Nicodemus to understand who he is and who he is going to be. Any other thoughts or questions before we end our class this morning? All right, thank you for being here.